Welcome back to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. You're in the Grey Lodge with me, Isaac Weisop. Today is the big day. We're wrapping it up, folks. This is the big one. Season 2, Episode 22. If you were living in 1991, you thought this was the series finale. It was all coming down to this. The episode's called Beyond Life and Death, aka Episode 29. And it's a very special episode. Near and dear to my heart. Is it the best episode in all of Twin Peaks? It might be. I don't know. That's a very tough distinction to make as to which would be the best episode. But today we're going to wrap it up. And it's not wrapped in plastic, folks. It's wrapped in the heaviest occult symbolism you could ever dream of. If the last episode was about love and opening up the doorway to the White Lodge, this is the opposing polarity of fear opening up the Black Lodge. This episode was released, from what I understand, back to back with the previous episode. A juxtaposition of the White and Black Lodge. And today we're going to wrap it up. We're going to walk through the symbolism. This is what you're in store for today. King Arthur and Glastonbury Grove. The 12 Rainbow Trout. Annie's Prayer and the Whore of Babylon. Wrapping up the storylines of Ed, Nadine, Donna, Ben Horn, Audrey, and Pete Martell. Cooper and Truman head to the woods. I'm also going to break down to you the symbolism of the Blue Rose. This is a big finding. Major key alert for the Twin Peaks hardcores. I'm going to tell you what the meaning of the Blue Rose really means. We're going to talk about the Double R Diner and the parallel realities. And then, of course, the Red Room. The iconic, infamous scene within the Red Room. We're going to cover, I mean, there's so much to do. Doppelgangers, Cooper's coffee test, the symbolism of, meanwhile, alleluia, alleluia. More Whore of the Babylon symbolism. The apocalyptic fire. And fear opening up the door to the Black Lodge. The stealing of souls, Solomon's altar of brass, breaking the fourth wall. It's all here, folks, and we're going to break it all down. It's a place both wonderful and strange. Here we go into it. And I got another reminder. You got to stick around because the next episode is where we're gonna do a little light decoding of this episode today. But the next episode, we're going to break down how this episode fits into the larger narrative of season 1 and season 2 and the occult messages of what's going on. For people who think this is just some wacky, crazy stuff, I'm going to reveal the truth to you, at least how I understand it and how I see it. An analysis of what's going on in Twin Peaks season 1 and season 2 is going to be the next episode. It's going to be iconic. Don't miss out. And note, this is season 2, episode 22. That's an angel number, 222. Lots of girls got it tattooed on their wrists out there. And 222, from what I read, is an angel number attributed to working towards your soul's purpose, aka your true will, which is what Cooper is doing in this episode. And I want to warn you that the first time I watched this episode, I was completely not ready, as maybe you were also not ready. I wasn't ready. I didn't even get it. And here's the thing. After completing all of Twin Peaks my first time, I wanted to move on with my regular life, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. I was like, I think I got to watch it again. And that's, you know, Twin Peaks pulled me in. It kept calling me because there's something mystical here. It's all about the Red Room, right? That Red Room. You don't have Twin Peaks without Red Room. You just don't. People wouldn't come back to it if it wasn't for Red Room. AKA the waiting room, AKA the Black Lodge, however you want to interpret this. You know, this whole episode is wild. Annie and Cooper freezing up in the magical woods, Truman staring off into Glastonbury Grove. And it's just like Cooper told Truman in the pilot. I have no idea where this will lead us. But I have a definite feeling it will be a place both wonderful and strange. And that's exactly what was delivered. One final note before we get into the analysis. Almost every character makes an appearance in this last episode, which is great. That was a good call. by David Lynch, who directed this episode. All right, here we go. Starts out with the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department. Apropos, Lucy and Andy are recapping what happened at Miss Twin Peaks on the last episode, because, you know, Wyndham Rail came through and crashed the party. And this is our final look at Lucy and Andy together. They appear to have made it through. Even though Lucy's a bit traumatized by the lights going out during the contest, the scene ends with them kissing and both saying, "I love you." And that's it for the White Lodge, folks. You can shut the door on love in the White Lodge, because we're going dark now. Next, we see Wyndham Earl, who abducted Annie at the Miss Twin Peaks contest. And, the last Cooper and Truman saw, Wyndham Earl took off with Annie, okay? Now we're still in the fire, or the sheriff's department, and Cooper is determined to find them by looking at this map. Again, with the Owl Cave petroglyphs. He says there's clues like the giant, the little man, fire walk with me. What does it all mean? And the fire walk with me is resonating with Cooper. He's not sure why. And Peter Martell storms in. He's Grand Theft Auto. And says that the log lady stole his truck. Cooper knows that it wasn't the log lady, though. He knows it was Wyndham Earl. His intuition is sharpening. Pete tells him his truck took off towards the woods. Cooper's like, Ghostwood Forest. I knew it. Pete says, there were 12 rainbow trouts in the bed of the truck. And simultaneously, Truman says, there are 12 sycamore trees in the forest at Glastonbury Grove. You got the symbolism of 12 with the zodiac. You got the symbolism of 12 with the 12 disciples of Jesus. It's not a coincidence. Now, Cooper also says that, he says the log lady is going to be there in just a minute. And guess who shows up? The log lady shows up. And this is also where we find out. I was just wondering if there were 12 knights of the round table, King Arthur. I don't see that. Anyway, this is also where Hawk chimes in. He says, you know, those pages from Laura's diary and that bloody towel? That's where I got all that stuff out in the woods. And Cooper says, the legendary burial place of King Arthur is at Glastonbury Grove. And we're going to come back to that in a minute because that's very important. So the log lady shows up on cue. Cooper looks at his watch right when she knocks on the door. Hands Cooper a jar of oil. Cooper has this odd grin and asks the log lady to tell them where she got the oil. And she says her husband, who's dead, brought it back before he died and said it was an opening to a gateway. Cooper gives it a little sniff. So does Truman. And they say it smells like scorched oil. And they recall Dr. Jacoby talking about scorched engine oil the night he got assaulted at the gazebo. They even bring Ronette Pulaski in. We haven't seen her in a while. And they make her smell the oil. She screams and she recognizes it from the night that Laura Palmer was killed. And if you recall, Maddie, the night she got killed, came down the stairs and says, what's that smell? It smells like burned oil. So the burnt oil is symbolic of something not good, something really dark and probably upsetting. Meanwhile, Wyndham Earl, he's got Annie. They're out in the woods at Glastonbury Grove in Pete's truck. And I'm going to play a clip for you. It's very long. And what I'm going to play for you is the sequence of events of how Wyndham Earl gets into the Black Lodge with Annie. He takes her out there. And she sort of gets entranced, and they're both sort of saying competing things to protect themselves. Take a listen.
Glastonbury Grove. I am Wyndham Earl.
Wyndham Earl?
Take a look at that. 12 rainbow trout.
You're gonna kill me, why don't you get it over with?
There's plenty of time for that. But I do like the fear I'm feeling.
All Our bones are scattered at the graves mount. This will one cutteth and cleaveth ward upon the earth. Mine eyes are unto thee, O God, the Lord, and this my trust, and not myself. Keep me from the snares which they have laid for me, and the gins of the workers of iniquity. Let the wicked fall into their own nets, whilst I withal escape. What are we doing here?
No, he won't.
Why are you doing this to me?
The same thing happened last time. When he fell in love with my wife, I took the boy right to the edge that time. Come in. Come in to the circle. I tell you, they have not died. Their hands clasp yours and mine. You'll not run from me now. Not in this circle of trees. You'll come with me.
So let's unpack that scene. He starts out, they're in the truck. Wyndham Earl has got the flashlight in his face, all creepy. Says he likes the fear that he feels from Annie. Because remember, Wyndham Earl knows that fear is also a way of getting into the Black Lodge, right? He shows her the 12 rainbow trout in the bed of the truck and drags her into the woods. And she's saying a prayer. Now, the prayer she's saying is from the King James Version of the Bible, Psalm 141. Verses 7 through 10, she says, or it says, our bones are scattered at the grave's mouth as when one cutteth and cleaveth wood upon the earth. But mine eyes are unto thee, O God, the Lord, in thee is my trust. Leave not my soul destitute. Keep me from the snares which they have laid for me, and the gins of the workers of iniquity. Let the wicked fall into their own nets, whilst that I withal escape. Now, what's interesting is that I looked this up in my trusty Orthodox Study Bible, and it has a totally different version of these verses, which it shows to be about understanding by David, I guess King David, when he was in the cave. I don't know. Says that Psalm 141, verse 2, was the sun in Israel, and now in the church, they do this during Vespers, offering incense to God. But it's quite a different one. It says, attend to my supplication, for I was humbled exceedingly. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison to give thanks to your name, O Lord. The righteous shall wait for me until you reward me. So Annie asked for God to leave not her soul destitute. So let's see how that plays out for her. She also asks for the wicked to fall into their own nets while she escapes. Do you think that happens? Does Wyndham Earl, the wicked, fall into his own net? We'll see. And I looked it up. I looked up 12 Knights of the Round Table, and I do think that's another reference. Yeah, 12 Knights of the Round Table. You got Sir Lancelot. Yeah. Anyway, so there are 12 Knights of the Round Table. So the 12 trout, 12 disciples, 12 knights of the round table. Because we're going to talk about King Arthur and how that's sort of a Jesus Christ comparison. All right. Wyndham Earl says to Annie, he says, I'm taking you to the end of the world. And that's really creepy, by the way, I should add. He says, taking her to the end of the world and how he drove Cooper to the edge the last time he did this. Of course, referencing... I think the implication is that he shot or stabbed Cooper in Pittsburgh back when Cooper was trying to protect Caroline. Something like that. But he says a poem when they get into the grove. He says, "They have not died, their hands clasped, yours and mine." And now this is from a poem that I've read is called "There Is No Death" by Gordon Johnstone. Seems to be true from what I can tell. There's a forum called TwinPeaksGazette.com. People are talking about it, and a seemingly well-informed user claims this poem is read in Freemasonry circles. I couldn't validate that. I was able to see on archive.org there's an entry for this poem, but it's actually a song by Jeffrey O'Hara with the words written by Gordon Johnstone. It says, "There is no death. I tell you, they have not died. They live and breathe with you. They walk here at your side. They tell you things are true." And that sounds a lot like these fallen spirits in the lodges, all right? "Why dreamed of poppy sod when you can feel their breath? When flower and soul and God knows there is no death. Death's but an open door. We move from room to room. There is one life, no more. No dying and no tomb." And I think the idea is that they're trying to say death doesn't exist. That's the title of the poem, "There Is No Death." So Ovs, and I'm thinking maybe they're talking about reincarnation because there's all these Buddhist elements of the story. But it keeps going. "Why seek ye them above those that ye love dear? The all of God is love, the all of God is here. I tell you, they have not died. Their hands clasp yours and mine. They are but glorified. They have become divine. They live, they know, they see, they shout with every breath. Life is eternity. There is no death." So Annie gets shoved into this circle at Glastonbury Grove. Her eyes freeze up. She locks up. And now she seems to be fully under Wyndham Earl's control. He says, "You'll not run from me now, not in this circle of trees. You'll come with me." And they disappear behind the red curtain that manifests out of nowhere. And there they go. Why did Wyndham want Annie this whole time? Why did he have to take her to the Red Room? Was it in order to lay a trap for Cooper to follow? Did it have anything to do with Annie being a nun? Was this revenge for Cooper sleeping with Caroline? Lots of questions. But I do want to take note of Annie's name and how she could be involved in all this. Her name is Annie Blackburn. Right? Like Black Lodge or Fire Walk With Me, Black Burn. So there's something there. Also, it should be noted that the oil at the Glastonbury Grove is, you know, it's the gateway, black oil. So we leave that scene and now we're back in Ed and Nadine's house. And we find out that during the Miss Twin Peaks fiasco, Nadine got knocked out with a sandbag. And what do you know? Now she's coming back to her true self. She's officially awoken from this mental condition that made her think she was in high school still. And she's completely unfamiliar with Mike, even though they're supposed to get married. And worse yet, she doesn't know where her drape runners are. And Ed, who was happily getting ready to move on with Norma, he's, of course, beside himself at this point. And he's not sure what to think of this. He goes, "How old are you?" And Nadine says, 35, you moron. And it's like, oh, okay, Nadine's back. It's so tragic. Ed was finally able to hook up with Norma. But now are we back to square one? Lynch leaves us hanging, right? So Donna, she's packing up her bags to leave home because she feels betrayed by her parents at this point. Because I think it was the last episode she found out it was implied that she knew Ben Horn was her father. And she's packing her bags. And Ben Horn's in her house now. Dr. Hayward comes home, tells Ben to get out of his house. Here comes Sylvia Horn. Better late than never. Where you've been since season one, episode 3. But here comes Sylvia. And all this chaos unfolds. Laura Flynn Boyle gives us Donna's last appearance and finest performance of the whole show. Take a listen.
I've heard enough.
Please don't let me explain.
Donna.
Leave me alone.
It isn't your parents' fault. It's mine.
My parents
I only wanted to do good. I wanted to be good. And it felt so good to tell the truth. After all these years.
Ben, damn it.
Will.
Donna. And I want you. Get out of my house.
Will. Can you forgive me for what I have done to you? Sylvia, I told you to stay home.
What are you trying to do to this family?
Daddy! You're my daddy. You're my daddy. You're my daddy. Daddy.
Leave my family alone.
Now, Will. Will!
Will! Ah! Oh! Oh!
It's a real tearjerker of a scene, folks. Donna's crying. She's hugging her dad, Dr. Hayward, who's not really your dad. You're my daddy. You're my daddy. Dr. Hayward, who wanted to keep this under wraps all of Donna's life, can't take it anymore, and he socks Ben Horn in the head, knocks him out cold. Ben actually, he bangs his head into the fireplace mantle, which is fitting because we've seen him by fireplaces this whole entire time on the show. And poor Donna, where's James when she needs him? He's out in Mexico. And man, Laura Flynn Boyle knocked it out of the park. This is the last time we're going to see her as Donna. She went out with a bang. Good job. Meanwhile, Andrew Packard, he's swapping out that safety deposit key, safety deposit box key with a fake one. Pete Martell walks in and catches him. They both act like it didn't happen. Back to the woods. Cooper and Truman, they're in hot pursuit of Wyndham Earl and Annie. They get in the woods. Cooper locks up, just like Annie did when she got inside the circle of trees. He locks up for a second, frozen. I suggest he's channeling something. And tells Truman, look, I got to leave behind. I got to go in alone. It's like he channeled a message that tells him he's got to go in alone. And from here, we get the classic Twin Peaks flashlights in the woods. As Cooper heads towards the circle of trees, Truman's quietly stalking and following a little bit from a distance. Cooper spots an owl, our last owl of Twin Peaks season 2, before seeing the grove of sycamore trees, and he spots that circle in the center, and he says, an opening to a gateway. That's where that black oil came from. That's where he needs to go. The red curtain manifest, Truman watching from a distance as Cooper dissolves into this curtain. What is Truman thinking? Truman's been on this journey the whole time, constantly wondering if Cooper wasn't crazy because he's not using the rational science of Truman's detective skills. And now he just seen it with his own eyes, something supernatural happened. Mind blown, right? And recall in season 2, episode 21, Truman and Cooper discussed how Wyndham Earl was going to get the queen, but the game of chess isn't over until he gets the king. Annie was the queen, and it was the move he performed in order to get the king. A little bit of checkmate. He got Cooper. That's what Annie was for. She was bait. Now's a good time we need to go down a King Arthur rabbit hole, because this is the time to do it. All right? There is a book called The Secret History of the World by Mark Booth, and it discusses the occult perspective of the history of the world, as you would imagine. And it talks about a concept of fertility and regenerative myths that play into the occult version of our world. All right. They talk about ancient Egypt and Isis, where, you know, Isis was wearing 7 veils to hide from Set while Isis and Nephis were searching for Osiris, her husband. They found, because Set broke Osiris up into 14 pieces. There's different versions of the tale. But Isis finds 13 of the 14 pieces. The only piece she's missing is the penis, which the fish in the Nile River ate. They were starving for some wiener. So they use linens to wrap up Osiris's 13 parts like a mummy, not wrapped in plastic, wrapped in linen, and she made a penis out of gold and proceeded to mount Osiris with the golden phallus and impregnated herself with the child Horus. Horus was a bit of an immaculate conception. At this point, Osiris became the king of the underworld while Horus was the new king of the real world. Horus sought revenge upon Set for killing Osiris and killed him. And this is where you get into the idea of the procession of the equinoxes with one constellation taken over after the other. It's the seasonal showing of the resurrection of the fertility with the annual cycle of the seasons. Sirius is on the horizon after being hidden for some time, and it's the sign that Osiris is resurrecting, and that to the ancient Egyptians meant the Nile River was going to be creating some fertile soil for them to have crops and have life, okay? And the argument presented in the book is that King Arthur followed the same pattern. The king is fatally wounded, the land stays barren, and in spring, magic resurrects King Arthur, and he fertilizes the land and saves the people. That's the mythology of King Arthur. The Golden Bough also detailed this, apparently, but the higher-level inner priests of the mystery schools knew of a bit more. But all of this applies to Twin Peaks, and we're going to cover that a bit more. But what about the Glastonbury Grove, right? We heard at the beginning of the episode that that's where King Arthur is buried. Well, in real life, the Glastonbury Grove, the burial place of this King Arthur, who we don't even know if is a real person or not, officially, it's claimed to be in Somerset at Glastonbury. And I'm going to read to you from an old friend of mine, Rosette de la Croix. I haven't talked to her in many, many years. We collaborated several times early in the blogging, podcasting days of 2014 and 15. I remember she wrote something about King Arthur, so I looked it up. She said, another part of the deception is the Glastonbury myth. Arthur was never based in Somerset. And she spells it out Sumer and Set. There's that Set again. The Holy Grail went through Wales, not England. Somerset is the home of the Templars and John the Baptist. Remember, the Templars pretended to worship John the Baptist when they really worshipped Lucifer. So you can see who is behind deceptively making Somerset Arthur's home. So apparently there's a connection there with the Templars. Now, I found interesting is Rosette talks about the symbolism of King Arthur, specifically the spiritual and temporal powers, right? Temporal meaning worldly, secular, of this world. And this is another way of saying the church and the state. The church is the spiritual, the state is the temporal. And the symbolism of King Arthur depicts this because the symbolism is shown as the shield is the spiritual power, okay? And the sword is the temporal power of the state. Arthur was shown with both a shield and a sword, meaning he has the power of church and state, of spiritual and temporal, kind of the master of all. She also talks about the symbolism of red and blue, where red is symbolic for the right, or Christ. Christ is depicted as the red rose, right? They show it as the red rose on the heart location at the center of the cross. You see on, I think it's the Protestant cross. Also, the Rosicrucians employ that symbolism. But Arthur was connected to the red rose, associated with the War of the Roses, with Lancaster's red rose versus the white rose of York. And Rosette claims that the War of Roses was after the real war of King Arthur versus King Cole. She also talks about the Game of Thrones was the white rose versus the red rose, where it was the Starks, they were the white rose and the Yorks, versus the Lannisters of Casterly Rock, which were the red rose of Lancaster. And now, side fact, I'm from Lancaster, PA, and there used to be a football game called the War of the Roses, because there's a city called York next to the city called Lancaster. Kind of, we employed that same symbolism in PA. So the War of the Roses is according to Rosette, a coded symbolic feud between Christ and Lucifer. And you're probably thinking, Christ is the red rose. Who was Lucifer the white rose? No, the blue is symbolic of Lucifer and the left. And when we talk about blue, you know, like look at the horse at the Denver International Airport. They call it Blucifer, right? It's a blue Mustang, but they call it Blucifer. But the point is that red symbolizes the right and Christ. Blue symbolizes left and Lucifer. And as you're going to find out when we do our Fire Walk With Me film analysis, we're going to dig deeper into this idea because the color blue and the blue rose is very important and integral to the story of Twin Peaks. The Hierophant tarot card shows a priest wearing blue under his red garment, which means outwardly worshiping Christ, but secretly worshiping Lucifer underneath. This was a tactic that goes back to the Assassins. Manly P. Hall talks about it in Secret Teachings of All Ages about how true initiates need to pretend like they're part of whatever group they're trying to infiltrate and control. That's the same concept. The red dragon is symbolic for King Arthur and the red rose and the blood of Christ. And of course, you know, you've got all the connections of the 12 disciples to the 12 knights of the round table with Christ at the center of the table, the Last Supper. King Arthur is at the center of the round table. The round table could be symbolic for the earth and the constellation. She said that the center of the earth is the North Pole, aka Polaris, and the Bear constellation, which is otherwise known as Arthur. And I had to dig in on this to look it up. Arthur is derived from the Roman Artorius, and the name Arthur only showed up in Britain around the 6th century. And the Arcturus is the Bear Watcher. That's the brightest star that follows the Ursa Major, the Great Bear constellation. Now, something else interesting, Rosette talks about the British head kings called the Paramounts. And Arthur was the 61st Paramount King. And who owns the rights to Twin Peaks Season 1 and Season 2? Paramount. That's where I watched them, on Paramount Plus. Plus, you've got this whole idea that Arthur died and is waiting to be resurrected or waiting to have his return like Christ. But now, let's switch gears and talk about in Season 1. Do you remember when Cooper said, who really killed JFK? Well, we talked about the synchromysticism of James Shelby Downard at that point. And I recall that he talked about Camelot. But the details are a little fuzzy. Interestingly enough, when researching King Kill 33, which I plan on doing an entire show talking about King Kill 33, this book that Downard wrote about the synchromysticism of the assassination of JFK, he actually mentions King Arthur in King Kill 33. He says, and I quote, using the magic and mystery of words, Beale onomatology is rendered thus, El, Bel, Baal, Beal, Beal, Beal. El is said to be one of the Hebrew names of God, signifying the Mighty One. It is the root of many other divine names and therefore many of the sacred names in Masonry. Approximately 1 mile from Lindisfarne, the Holy Island or Holy House, is a barren place known as Beal. Lindisfarne is associated with Herodom and the legends of King Arthur, the Round Table, Merlin, and other Camelot stories, as well as the Scottish Black Watch. So to sum it up, what is he saying here? Downard is talking about how this cabal uses magic words and sacred geometry and gematria to encode ritual events. He ties the location of the word Beale to King Arthur. And in particular, in his theory, he's talking about how JFK was born on Beale Street in Brookline, Massachusetts. But the point is, Cooper is the archetype of King Arthur. He is the king of the chessboard, and he's going to Glastonbury Grove, the burial site of King Arthur, aka the place where King Arthur is resting until his triumphant return. Hence the name of Twin Peaks Season 3. It's called Twin Peaks The Return. I've actually got a couple more theories that I'm going to talk about in the next episode where we wrap all this up about the return. There's actually many different meanings behind that. Now, to drive the point home even further, this script, I'm going to read you from the script for this episode. Near the center of the grove, the air seems to shapeshift, move, and alter. Truman stands, moving closer. A gleaming white sword appears in the oscillating air, and from behind it, a hand holding a silver sword. Truman is mesmerized. He now sees that holding the shield and sword is a tall, dark woman wearing a glittering chainmail. She sees Truman, holds the sword out towards him. Truman says, "Oh my God, oh my God." In a loud snap, image of the woman vanishes, and we cut to a black corridor. And the theory is that the chainmail and the sword, this is the Lady of the Lake that gave the sword of Excalibur. Well, there's a couple swords in the King Arthur story. There's the Lady of the Lake that has the sword, and then there's the Excalibur that he pulls from the stone. Some versions of the mythology conflate the two. Point is, it's just another idea that Lynch was referring to King Arthur. Cooper is the same archetype here, maybe. Okay? Now, back to the show. We're now in the iconic, infamous Red Room. We cue up Jimmy Scott singing about the sycamore trees. The little man is strutting around the room with the black and white jagged floor. Technically, it's brown and white from everything I've read about Twin Peaks, but I'll be damned because I thought there was a black and white floor the whole time. And Cooper, he's froze up. He's staring. He's froze up. He's not saying anything. I mean, it's probably because he had dreams about this and now he's in it. The dream has become reality. And that Jimmy Scott gives me goosebumps when he's singing. We also see Cooper's eyes. He's frozen in what looks like sheer horror and terror. There's strobe lighting going off. Doesn't feel like anything good is going to come from this. And the strobing reminds me of the last episode with the Miss Twin Peaks when Wyndham Earl took over. Meanwhile, Andy heads out to the woods to help Truman. Then we get some classic Twin Peaks shots of the foggy woods. Love that. The bridge run at Pulaski was walking across in the pilot. the Glastonbury Grove. And now Truman and Annie, they're sitting on a log, of all things. They're sitting on a log. And we find out it's 10 hours later. Truman and Annie are still waiting to see Cooper's return from this other realm. And take a listen to this conversation.
Been about 10 hours since he went in there. Do you want a thermos of coffee? Yeah. Do you want a plate special? Do you want dessert? Yeah. Do you want pie? Harry? Harry?
Now it seems like silly Lynchian stuff, right? But what's going on here? Andy asked Truman if he wants a thermos of coffee. He's like, yeah, disinterested, but yeah. A plate special, yeah. Dessert, yeah. Pie. Truman doesn't answer. Andy's like, Harry? Harry? Cut scene. Truman is shook. He's realizing the paranormal that Cooper kept talking about is so real. His whole world collapses in on itself. Why doesn't Truman respond to the question about the pie? Why is that the one that sort of breaks him from reality? It's because it's saying that Twin Peaks has taken a dark turn, I think. I believe Truman is snapped out of his samskara. Samskara being the repetitive patterns of reincarnation. The donut, the circle. Every day it's donuts, coffee, pie. Something has now shaken Truman to his core. It's the reality of the madness that Cooper has been trying to tell him about since he showed up in Twin Peaks, yet Truman's earthly ways are very resistant to accept. Now he's staring at him right in the face. And you also notice we hear birds singing. And way back at the beginning in season 1, episode 3, we heard about how the Red Room, the birds sing a pretty song. We take a break from all the supernaturalness. And now we're at the bank. And here comes Audrey. All right, here comes Audrey. And she instructs the loan officer, Del Mibler, to call the Twin Peaks Gazette, talk to the editor, Dwayne Milford, because she's about to disrupt things. She's chaining herself to the vault in protest of their financial ties to the Ghostwood Development Project and its negative effect upon the environment and the Ghostwood National Forest, doing Ben Horn's work. She asks for a glass of water. We get the very Lynchian, painfully slow shot of the old teller walking to retrieve the water. This scene takes forever, especially because you're wanting to get back in the woods in the Red Room. Here comes Andrew Packard and Pete Martell with that safety deposit key. No Catherine Martell. What? Where's she? And they scooch past Audrey, who's now chained to the door in the vault, which is a far less disruptive protest since they can just walk around her. So now you got these three old dudes walking as slow as they can over to the safety deposit box to open it up. The phone in the bank rings. A security guard's yelling, "It's a boy, it's a boy." They finally open up the box. They find an activated bomb. It says, "Got you, Andrew, love, Thomas." And it blows up the vault. Thomas Eckhart had apparently planned this part out a long time ago. And recall how Josie threatened Ben Horn with a safety deposit key back in season 2, episode 6. Del Mibler had even said it was his fortunate day when Audrey showed up. Now it appears it was his final day. And it explodes. We see cash falling everywhere. We see the teller's glasses hitting the tree. And it's implied they're all dead. I mean, is that really how Audrey Horne goes out in Twin Peaks? Say it ain't so. And Pete Martell? Now, Pete, we started our entire Twin Peaks journey with Pete telling us she's dead, wrapped in plastic. And now he's dead. Full circle, see? The madness of David Lynch. We've gone full circle. Now, we're going to find out more about all these things later. I'm not going to reveal anything, but you need to stick with the storyline to get more about what happens and so on. Okay. One more scene before we're back in the Red Room for the iconic end of the whole episode. We'll go back to the Double R Diner. Of course, the Double R's got to be in the final episode. And we got a very intense scene. Bobby and Shelley talking about getting married. Shelley says she's still wearing Leo's ring. They do a little barking thing like dogs, which we saw in the pilot when Bobby was in the jail cell with Mike, with Snake. And Heidi comes in, and they have almost the same verbatim script from the pilot about her getting bratwurst from her old man. Bobby saying he thought the Germans were always on time. Take a listen.
Shelly, I think we should get married.
Bobby? Leo, I'm still wearing his ring. Oh, what kept us, Heidi? Second son knock course this morning?
I couldn't get my car started.
Too busy jump-starting the old man.
Again. I thought you Germans were always on time. Shelley.
Bobby.
Leo's probably up in the woods having the time of his life.
Why would we get this reference to the pilot? Is this the Samsara circle that we keep seeing?
Second son knock course this morning.
Couldn't get my car started.
Too busy jump-starting the old man.
Again. I thought the Germans were always on time.
You know, we just talked about that. About Truman breaking from it. About Pete Martell starting the show and then dying. It's a bit about staying on the same loop and never breaking free, but then what does that imply? Does that imply we're in different parallel realities? Bobby and Shelley are definitely not the type to become enlightened in this lifetime, so I would argue that it's a reboot of sorts. All right. It could be that something with the astrological alignments of Saturn and Jupiter being in conjunction and opening this doorway for this brief moment in time, it's doing something with a parallel reality or repeating history or something. Something paranormal is happening with the timelines. I don't know the answers to that yet. I feel like we're going to have to get into season 3 to really solve that one. So we're still in the Double R Diner, and here comes Sarah Palmer, Laura's mother, who we haven't seen in a long time, and Dr. Jacoby wearing his Dracula cape, and they've got to give a message to Major Briggs. And you won't believe what she tells him. Take a listen.
Excuse us, Major Briggs, for the intrusion, but Sarah here had a message for you that she felt was important.
Sarah.
Sure.
Lodge with Dan Cooper.
I'm wasting for you.
Sarah tells Briggs, Major Briggs, in her, in what sounds like Wyndham Earl's voice, "I'm in the Black Lodge with Dale Cooper." Unbelievable. You know, lots of questions here. And first, notice, and again, I put the images on the Instagram, but Jacoby, he came in with his Dracula cape on, but he had a tie with keys all over it. And we have a lot of key symbolism in this final episode. It's considered the most important symbol in Freemasonry, and it represents the unlocking of the mysteries. Sarah also has spirals all over her dress. Spirals are, of course, symbolic for reincarnation or opening gateways. You see that on the Alcave petroglyph map, by the way, is those spirals. Now, hang on, I got to type up notes. So now why, or better yet, how, does Wyndham have a connection with Sarah to relay this message to Major Briggs? Is it, he's unlocked these, he's been in the Red Room for a minute. Is he in the Black Lodge? Does he now have powers to sort of affect the real world? Does that have anything to do with the parallel realities we're experiencing? Why did he choose to send this message to Major Briggs? Is it because he was part of Project Blue Book together? And he's the only person that would understand this message? No one else is going to get it. They're going to say, what? What's the Black Lodge? Is he trying to lure Briggs into the lodge to save Cooper? We don't know. We then see the Red Room and the man from another place. That's the correct term. I don't know what I've been calling him up to this point. The little guy. He says, "I am waiting for you." Then, presumably in 1991, people sat through what felt like the longest commercial break in history. And that's basically it for the town of Twin Peaks, because the rest of the episode, almost entirely, is the Red Room. You'll notice, and when we get into the Red Room, you're going to notice the mapping of it doesn't make any sense. Cooper will go up the hall and reappear in the corner of the room at one time, in the opposite corner at another time. It reminds me of the house in The Shining. You'll also notice the perspective does some shifts. Sometimes the viewer becomes part of the show. Characters appear, they disappear, they shift into other characters. Doppelgangers appear. It's maddening. And to me, it's unbelievable this thing aired on national television. There's no way anybody was ready for this in 1991. There's just no way. Notice how the camera will, you know, sometimes it feels like you're a viewer in the room. Sometimes you're an observer. We're going to talk about that. It's important. So first, and I'm going to play you clips from it, and it might seem long and drawn out, especially if you're not watching the video version of this show, which if you're not, you know, you can upgrade to tier two. I know. I hate it. I hate that I have made Grifter Alley for supporters, but that's what happened. I started a Patreon forever ago. They wanted different tiers of goodies, and the tier two goodies is the video version of the show, so that's just the way it is. But yeah, if you're just listening to this episode, my apologies if it seems like some of these are long and drawn out, but just enjoy it. Just relax. Everything's great. So this clip is going to be a long one. It's the first scene in the Red Room, okay? And we're going to get the man from another place talking to Cooper from the couch. Laura Palmer shows up, and so does the giant and the butler and all kinds of madness. Take a listen.
When you see me again, it won't be me. This is the waiting room. Would you like some coffee? Some of your friends are real.
Hello, Ashley and Spoofer. I'll see you again in 25 years. Meanwhile,
hallelujah!
Hallelujah!
Coffee. 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 Coffee.
All right, let's try our best to decode this. The man from another place says, when you see me again, it won't be me. What does that mean? Is he talking about a doppelganger, which shows up here in a minute? Side note, do I want to tell you this? I'm not going to say this. I'm going to hold that back. It was almost a prophetic statement from the actor who plays this. Now, the man from another place reveals that the Red Room is actually called the waiting room. He says, welcome to the waiting room. But in the captions, you're going to notice it's all lowercase, which tells me it's not a subject. It is a verb. It is the waiting room. Waiting for what? The act of waiting. And if we're talking about waiting, we're talking about time, which is a construct that mythologically came to us by way of Saturn. Saturn gives us time and constraints. That's why they call Kronos or Saturn Father Time. And time is the most terrifying construct. That's probably the most disturbing element of Twin Peaks. In fact, you see Saturn sitting right next to Dale Cooper in the waiting room, in the Red Room. And I'm going to use these terms interchangeably constantly. The waiting room, the Red Room, the Black Lodge. It's not crystal clear as to which one's which. I got to guess the man from another place knows what's what. So it's, I guess, the waiting room. So the man from another place asks if Cooper would like some coffee. He says some of his friends are here. Here comes Laura Palmer. She does this weird reverse snap of her fingers with two fingers down. She tells Cooper, I'll see you again in 25 years. Meanwhile, and she holds her hands up, right? She holds her hands up. Now, it's claimed online, if you look this up, that the hand pose is a mudra in Hinduism, with the citation being James, the guy who plays James, at a Comic-Con in Eugene, Oregon, calling it a mudra, which just means a hand gesture in Hinduism. And on Reddit, someone claimed it's the Abhaya Mudra, which is a gesture of fearlessness, reassurance, and safety, and provides divine protection, which would make a lot of sense, right? But when you read that mudra, and you look that up, and a lot of people repeat this, and I don't know why, It's described as the right palm held outwards and upright, which is absolutely not how she has her hands oriented. She has her hands oriented like David Bowie's album. Right? Which album was that? I'm just thinking of this. I should know this off the top of my head. Heroes. No, that's not the name of the album. It's the name of the track. Heroes album cover. Okay, well. She has it more like that, but not quite the same as that either. But the point is, that's not what that is. That is not how she has her hands oriented. She has her right hand oriented inwards and upright. And the mudra they're confusing it with is the mudra we've seen a million times with the sitting lotus position Buddha with the right hand facing outward and the left like a stop almost and the left hand laying down, not even near the right hand. So I don't know why that got perpetuated. At best, it's an inversion of that. But anyway, I don't buy the online theory. I still don't know what it means, though. I couldn't tell you. And it's not a plot spoiler to reveal that she, in fact, would see Cooper 25 years later in season 3. Now, the whole scene feels like a bad dream, a hallucination. There's different characters coming in. I mean, the man from another place did say all of his friends were there. And I'm going to have... Stick with me for the Fire Walk With Me film analysis because there's a connection to that snapping, right? So Laura disappears, and the butler shows up now, and he does this noise with his mouth. The woo, 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 woo. And you're going to hear this in Fire Walk With Me. And he says, "Hallelujah." And the man from another place repeats. He offers Cooper coffee several times, obnoxiously. Drops off a cup of coffee on Cooper's Saturn table. And then he turns into the giant. And we can't gloss over this because the term hallelujah is, of course, from the Christian faith. Its usage is described in the book of Revelation in chapter 19, which the Orthodox Study Bible describes as the Litany of Triumph in Heaven, which is the section celebrating the fall of the Whore of Babylon. And we're going to dive deep into the Whore of Babylon on the next episode where we wrap up everything. And we're going to wrap up the meaning of the coffee. It's a test, I think. But the giant sits back down and he says, "One and the same," and then disappears. Who's one and the same? The butler and the giant? That's what it seems like, right? Seems like they're good guys from the White Lodge. Maybe? The giant and the man from another place, are they one and the same? They're both on the owl petroglyph. So the man from another place, he rubs his hands together very nefariously. Cooper can't resist the coffee. Grabs the cup. Stop short of drinking it to reveal that it's a solid mass inside the cup. But then it's not. Then he pours it out and there's a little bit of liquid. Then it's sludge, which I would suggest is like the black scorched engine oil at the gateway to the Black Lodge. Man from another place is looking off into the room, into the corner, which we can't see. And he says, "Wow, Bob, wow," an anagram. Tells Cooper, "Fire walk with me," before it goes black, and we get our first apocalyptic fire explosion. We hear screaming. The room is now strobe lighting, and it's empty. And this is where things take a real dark turn, folks. Recall, season 2, episode 19, Pete Martell says, "Wowie Bob," when he sees the mysterious black box. It's almost like we've got a conscious realm manifesting into the red room as a subconscious projection, a dream realm. Wow, Bob, wow, and wowee, Bob. Seems odd. Is there a meaning to the strobing or the fire? It seems like it only happens at certain times. I've got some ideas. The strobing reminds me of lightning, which makes me think of Kenneth Grant's from the Typhonian OTO. He's talking about Nodens and the lightning bolt flashing to awaken the goddess with the mark of the Antichrist. But we'll come back to that. Cooper gets up from the chair. He goes into the hallway of the waiting room, opens a curtain to another room with chairs that's identical. Then he turns back to the first room, which is identical. You know, three chairs, Saturn lamp, statue of Venus de Medici. The Venus de Milo is in the hallway. That's the one without the arms. And what's the meaning of those statues? Both of these statues are about the Greek god of love, Aphrodite. All right. Makes me think it's White Lodge, right? Because remember, love, White Lodge, fear, Black Lodge. And recall in season 2, episode 18, Cooper takes Gordon Cole to the Double R Diner. And remember, Gordon was really into Shelley. Cole says Shelley reminds him of the statue without any arms, the Venus de Milo. So again, you've got this weird thing of the conscious projecting onto the unconscious dream realm. There's a connection there. And this statue is seen in Sherilyn Fenn's Boxing Helena film, directed by Jennifer Lynch. If you haven't seen Boxing Helena, you're in for a real treat, folks. But that statue is also in that film, directed by David Lynch's daughter. And, of course, in that room, you've got the uprights of the Boaz and Joaquin, possibly. I mean, they look like lights. I don't know. That's a stretch. So Cooper gets back to room one. The man from another place tells him wrong way. So he goes back to the second room, and he shows up in the opposite corner as he did before. Previously, he showed up in the northwest corner. That's what I'm calling it. Now he's in the southeast corner facing the chairs. The man from another place makes some terrifying noises. Tells Cooper, another friend, in the creepiest manner possible. In walks Maddie. She says, watch out for my cousin, before dissipating. It's actually very terrifying to me, this whole thing. The camera stays behind Cooper's shoulder, and we never get a close look at Maddie. She's in the distance. And why does she say, watch out for my cousin? Recall in the pilot, we heard the Laura Palmer in the Red Room said she was Laura's cousin. Cooper leaves that second room, goes in the hallway back to room one. Now there's no furniture in room one. Again, it's like The Shining. It makes no sense. He ends up in a room with no furniture. The man from another place appears out of nowhere, and we get this terrifying scene. He looks possessed because now he's got white eyes, and he says, doppelganger. Then we see Laura with the white possessed eyes, and she says, meanwhile, and gives a blood-curdling scream. You see a flash of Wyndham Earl in there, and Cooper runs away. Now, lots of things are happening with this, right? We see the strobing lights again when Laura says, meanwhile, or the doppelganger Laura. And remember, when Cooper came into the room, it was empty. Then the doppelganger of a man from another place shows up. Then Laura's doppelganger shows up with a chair now, of all things. And it's terrifying because we know Laura as this tragic figure, but this version is straight up demonic. And Cooper running away symbolizes fear, all right? Now we know he's scared. He's emitting fear. He ran away. You could see it on his face when the doppelganger of Laura first ran up on him, which could have been Wyndham Earl in disguise or something. So the fear has set in. Now, I believe we transition, and now it's the Black Lodge, right? He's bleeding from the abdomen, and he looks at his own blood trail, and he follows it back to the other room. And this is when you see that the Venus de Medici is missing completely. I think Cooper's fear opened up the Black Lodge where Wyndham Earl wants him, and now he's in. So he goes back into the room, sees himself and Caroline lying on the floor bleeding. But then it turns out it's not Caroline, it's Annie. And just that quick, she disappears. And this is the first time we hear Cooper talk. He calls out for Caroline, then he calls out for Annie. I mean, this is what dreams feel like. It's trying to explain a dream, right? We see some more strobing around. And around here is where I think Cooper's doppelganger manifests, even though we don't see him. There's a lot of fear building in Cooper, and I think it's opening up doors, just like Major Briggs warned Cooper, I should say. And at this point, this is where things get interesting. We get a first-person point of view of Cooper going back into the hallway towards room two. He's searching for Annie, all right? I'm going to play this clip. It's very long. And this is where Cooper catches up with Annie, and Wyndham Earl shows up, and Wyndham says, if you give me your soul, I will save Annie. And of course Cooper does it. And then Bob shows up, and Bob's like, not in my house, son. Take a listen.
Annie?
tail. I saw the face. Someone who helped me.
Annie. The face of the man who killed you.
He was my husband.
Annie.
Who's Annie? Helps me. Helps me.
Caroline.
You must be missed again. I'm alive.
If you give me your soul, I let Annie live.
I will.
Let's unpack everything we saw here. We got Cooper finding Annie. She says she saw the face of the man who killed her. But remember, she's not dead as far as we know, or Cooper for that matter. And she says it was her husband. And Cooper's like, Annie? And she says, who's Annie? And now it's Caroline, right? And she says, it's me. But she's got the white possessed eyes. And it makes more sense if it was Caroline since her husband did kill her. So why does Cooper keep seeing Annie and Caroline together, right? Now it's Annie again, and she says, you must be mistaken. I'm alive. And then turns into possessed Laura, who screams, and then it's Wyndham Earle. Which makes sense because Wyndham Earle is a master of disguise, as we've seen. And he's been unlocking even more powers of the Black Lodge. His disguise game is on point. And he tells Cooper, if he gives him his soul, he'll let Annie live. And she's now watching from the side. And then she disappears. And of course, Cooper goes for it. He's like, I'll save Annie. Take my soul. So Wyndham stabs him. We see another fiery apocalypse and more strobing. And why does Wyndham Earle want Cooper's soul? Is that what these Black Lodge types are into? Stealing souls. And this draws again the question of timelines, because it seems that we're already going backwards in time a little bit here, since Cooper was apparently already stabbed before he showed up in the room. Remember, he followed his own blood trail. The camera also implies that the stabbing got reversed, showing the knife coming back out of Cooper before Bob shows up again. You'll also notice in the background, there's a golden altar of sorts, and you can't really see it too well, but it's there. And I say it's an altar because this is the moment when Wyndham stabs Cooper for his soul, a blood sacrifice. And recall in season 2, episode 20, that Wyndham Earl videotape that Truman and Cooper watched, where he was talking about the Dugpas, which I connected to blood sacrifices. Well, if you go look to Lon Milo Duquette's book on the Key to Solomon's Key, on page 165, he has the Vessel of Brass. I'll try to put a photo on the Instagram for you. Let me make a note. He's got a thing called the Vessel of Brass, which looks similar to the table, to this altar in the Red Room. It was meant for King Solomon to hold evil spirits. Now, it's not a dead-on exact spitting image, but it looks similar to me. At least that's what it reminded me of. So the room starts strobing. Bob is then seen possessing or controlling Wyndham Earl. Bob yells at Wyndham Earl to be quiet. And it sounds like there's two audio tracks a little bit. I'm not sure what the other one is saying, but the captions are telling me it says be quiet. And Bob is mad because he says that Wyndham Earl can't ask for Cooper's soul. Bob said he will take Wyndham's soul. And we see a depiction of it as a flame shooting out from Wyndham's head, where the crown chakra is. The kundalini energy is when you reverse the kundalini serpent energy, that's allegedly how it comes out too. The Baphomet shows that, right? The Baphomet shows the flame coming out of the head. But Bob catches the flame. And Wyndham's voice goes from silent screaming to full screaming. It's nuts. What a crazy scene this is. And these apocalyptic fires, it seems like they have something to do with souls, and it makes me wonder if that's the real meaning of fire walk with me, to take someone's soul with you. We're going to cover that more in the conclusion. Now, right after Bob takes Wyndham Earl's soul, Cooper leaves the room, and Bob did tell him, you go. But here's where it's odd. We know that the hallway just goes back to the same room, like a loop, right? So we see Cooper leave, go into the hallway. Simultaneously, Shadow Cooper lurks down the hallway that we can see in the curtain in the room on the other side. And then we see what is the doppelganger or the shadow of Cooper sneaking into the room after getting tripped up in the red curtains. And this is Cooper's doppelganger, and comes in with the white possessed eyes, and he's laughing with Bob like a demon. Now, he comes in like a whirlwind of sorts, right? When he's all caught up in those red curtains. And I have a theory about that we're going to dig into on the next episode. You're not going to believe this one. That has a meaning. If you watch this episode and you always wonder, why is the Shadow Cooper so goofy? Like he's tripping around in the red curtains. There's a occult meaning for that. So we now have Cooper's shadow merging with Bob, and they laugh maniacally. Classic Twin Peaks scene. So now the real Cooper, like I said, he went out in the hallway. He sees possessed Leland, who tells Cooper he did not kill anybody. My Red Room voice sounds like Borat. Sorry. I haven't mastered speaking in reverse yet. So Cooper gets back into room one, and his doppelganger is now following him, and he gives Leland a little devious look, and it's clear that the possessed eyes are all dark, right? This is all a dark side. This is the Black Lodge. And this is an important scene because Shadow Cooper, after he gives evil Leland a little look, he's following good Cooper, and right before he goes into the room through those curtains, he looks at the camera. You have to see that. I'll put the image on the Instagram. He looks into the camera in what is the most insidious, creepiest grin you've ever seen. David Lynch had it so that the Shadow Cooper, the evil Cooper, breaks the fourth wall. A concept in, you know, film and television where the characters talk directly to the audience. You see it at the end of Hodorowski's Holy Mountain. It's a way of bringing the initiation into your living room. And he does it again when Shadow Cooper is chasing the real Cooper. He stares straight up in the camera and gives it this sort of terrifying look. And these doppelgangers are straight up demonic. I don't know how Lynch portrayed these things so evil by simply making their eyes white, but it makes your skin crawl. And when you see evil Cooper looking into the camera, that's the Shadow Cooper looking into your living room. Lynch is bringing you into the Black Lodge. So Cooper and his doppelganger, they're chasing each other around the rooms. We see one of them capture the other. It seems like the Shadow catches real Cooper. And, you know, it's assumed that that's what happens. It's kind of hard to see. The room starts strobing. And then you see Bob also break the fourth wall, and he's staring at the camera too. It's drawing the viewers in deeper. It's speaking to the subconscious is what it's doing. You're not a casual observer anymore. Now you're part of it. The Red Room scene is over. We're back to Glastonbury Grove. Truman's still out there in the woods. A full day later, it's nighttime again now. Cooper and Annie manifest. They're both unconscious. And as we're watching it, we're thinking, oh, thank goodness. Oh, it was all just a bad dream or something. Now we see the beautiful Snoqualmie Falls one more time. Cooper wakes up. He's in the Great Northern. Oh, thank goodness. This is all so great. This is good stuff, right? This is what we always wanted. And Truman and Dr. Hayward are there. He, of course, asks where Annie is. They say she's in the hospital. And it makes me think about the prayer she gave about evil ensnaring itself in its own net. That was Wyndham Earle. He got ensnared in his net when Bob took his soul. And Annie made it out. She lived through it. God answered her prayer. Cooper, he wakes up. He says, I need to brush my teeth. He gets up to go to the bathroom. He repeats it again. Truman's just like, yeah, good idea, Cooper. Go brush your dumb teeth. Cooper gets in there. He grabs a toothbrush, squeezes all the toothpaste into the sink, and now we're worried. We're like, why is Cooper doing that? And he looks at himself in the mirror, and he smashes his head into it, and you can see Bob in the reflection. He starts laughing at his own bloody face and starts maniacally repeating, how's Annie, how's Annie, laughing over and over. And that's how the show ends. That's how you finish a show. Oh my God. I bet people were so livid with that ending. The good guy didn't clearly win. It seems like evil won. Our hero is stuck. Our favorite ladies, they're all dead. Shelley made it. But Audrey might have blown up in the bank. Annie, we don't know. She's in the hospital. But the good Cooper's stuck in the Black Lodge. Now we've got this evil Cooper Bob. We got Cooper Bob. And now it all makes sense. When evil Cooper wakes up, he says, "I wasn't sleeping," to Truman and Dr. Hayward in the room. That's what he says. That's the first thing he says. "I wasn't sleeping." And he says, "I got to go brush my teeth." He says he wasn't sleeping because he's been waiting. This evil Cooper, Bob, whatever the hell this is, has been waiting to manifest into our world from the Red Room, from the Black Lodge this whole time. He wasn't sleeping. He was waiting. He was waiting in the waiting room. And then the credits roll. And in case your mind isn't already scrambled and wondered what the hell was going on, the final shot, the final image from Twin Peaks, season 2, they show the cup of coffee in the Red Room on the table, on the Saturn table, I would assume. And in it, you see an image of Laura manifested, smiling and inverted inside the cup of coffee. And I've got theories for all of this. The coffee test. So much going on in this final episode. I've been working on this for weeks, folks. Weeks and weeks and weeks. I couldn't believe a 15-minute segment of a show took me weeks to analyze and unpack. But stick around, because on the next episode, we're going to unpack all of this. We're going to talk about the symbolism of what we saw. We're going to make some major connections with spiritual battles, the Whore of Babylon. It's all here. We're going to unpack the entire... We're going to go all the way back to the beginning of season 1. And we're going to talk about what these characters' meanings were, the symbolism of the woods and the fire and doppelgangers and duality, and how that fits into this crazy occult concept, parallel dimensions, unlocking. And we're going to specifically describe what happened in the Red Room, where Cooper is, and where do we go from here. And from there, we're gonna get into, I think the next work we're going to unpack is The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. But you got to stick around, because I'm gonna decode pretty much all of Twin Peaks on the next episode. And that's going to be the banger of all bangers. Thank you for being with me on this journey. This is a course. And you know what's funny is, the more originally I said I'm going to write a book. And the more I do this, I realize this book is too big. I don't know if I could do it. This might be too much of a book. It's going to be monstrous. Anyway, we'll see. Maybe I'll never do the book. Maybe it's just going to be these podcast series, which is fine. But anyways, thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. Come back next time where we're going to unpack the whole mystery, at least to the best of my knowledge of what I can come up with. Thank you for listening. Till next time, stay positive.